The tiny reconnaissance drone crossed the border between Laos and North Vietnam. It leveled out at 500 feet above ground level. Cody 193 took no notice of the rounds which passed within feet of it, following the flight path programmed into its brain. "Keep going, baby," a major whispered to himself, watching his scope carefully. Colonel Robin Zacharias, United States Air Force, was walking across the dirt compound. A prisoner for over 6 months, he faced every day as a struggle. Worse, his co-pilot was dead, and he was probably the lucky one, the colonel thought, as he was led across the compound by two small, unfriendly men with rifles. Paraded through three separate villages, stoned and spat upon, he'd finally ended up here, wherever here was. There was little comfort to be had here. There were other prisoners, but his attempts at communicating with them had all failed. His only consolation, he thought, was that things were as bad as they could be. On that, he was wrong. "Good morning, Colonel Zacharias," a voice called across the compound. He looked up to see a man taller than himself, Caucasian, and wearing an unfamiliar uniform. That was when he heard a noise, a thin, screeching whine. He turned on instinct. It appeared in an instant before the guards had a chance to react. "Drone," Zacharias thought, standing erect, turning to watch it pass, holding his head up, seeing the black rectangle of the camera window, praying that the device was working. When the guards realized what he was doing, a gun butt in the kidneys dropped the colonel to the ground. Cody 193 continued northeast. "Go, baby, go," the major said, 200 miles away, as he followed the blinking blip of the radar transponder. At the end of its journey, the drone was retrieved, and its film cassette rushed to the laboratory. "Let me see," the captain said tensely when the film was developed. There was a man there on the image, an American with two guards and a fourth man, but it was the American he wanted to see. An hour later, he boarded a flight to Da Nang, then to the Philippines, then headed directly to California. The captain slept briefly and fitfully, having solved a mystery whose answer might just change the policy of his government. Kelly slept nearly 8 hours, arising to find that Pam wasn't there. He went outside and saw her standing on the quay. Kelly walked out quietly and touched her. "Good morning." She didn't answer, and Kelly stood still, holding her lightly.
"So, now you know," she said, unable to face him.
"Yes," Kelly answered quietly.
"What do you think about me?"
"Think you're beautiful. I'm real glad we met."
"I do drugs."
"The docs say you're trying to quit. That's good enough for me."
"It's worse than that. I've done things."
"I don't care about that, Pam. I've done things, too. But you gave me something to care about, and I didn't ever expect that to happen." Kelly pulled her tighter. "The things you did before we met don't matter. You're not alone, Pam. I'm here to help, if you want me to."
"When you find out," she warned,
"I'll take my chances. I love you, Pam." Kelly surprised himself with those words. Again, emotion won out over reason, and reason, for once, found itself approving.
"How can you say that?" Pam asked.
Kelly turned her around and smiled. "Damned if I know. Maybe it's your tangled hair or your runny nose. No, I think it's your heart. No matter what's behind you, your heart is just fine."
"You mean that, don't you?"
she asked, looking at his chest. Then she smiled up at him, and it was like a dawn. Kelly wiped the tears from her face.
"I'm so scared,"
she whispered. Kelly pulled her close. "It's okay to be scared." His hands rubbed up and down her back. Then he realized that his hands were rubbing over scars made by men with whips. Then his eyes looked straight out over the water, and it was just as well that she couldn't see his face. "That took long enough," Tony observed. He was tired. Eddie grumbled something and went topside. Henry, the tall black man, was bagging the product and kept out of the argument.
It had actually worked out better than he'd planned. They'd even bought his story about Angelo, thus eliminating one potential partner and problem. There was at least $300,000 worth of finished drugs being weighed and sealed for sale to dealers. And this was just the beginning. Henry Tucker was just giving them a taste. Tucker stood, looking out the tiny porthole, wondering why it was that he had to do all the hard work. The answer, he reflected, was easy. Tony was a made man. Eddie wanted to become one. He would never be, and neither would Angelo, Tucker reflected. He'd never trusted Angelo. And now, he was no longer a problem. These people would keep their word as long as he was their connection to the raw material, and not 1 minute longer. Tucker had no illusions about that. With luck, Angelo's would be the last killing for a while. Yeah, there was danger, but Henry Tucker's reward for less than a day's work was $100,000 in untaxed cash, and he was willing to risk a lot for that. Memorial Day, Dutch Maxwell thought, alighting from his official car at Arlington National Cemetery. To many, just a day off, but not to him, and not to his fellows. This was their day, a time to remember fallen comrades while others attended to other things. Admiral Podolsky got out with him, and the two admirals walked slowly to pay their respects to vanquished fellows. Rear Admiral James Greer was at his place, as he'd been for the previous 2 years, setting flowers next to the flag at the headstone of his son. Without a spoken word, all three men lined up to face the headstone of Robert White Greer, 1st Lieutenant, United States Marine Corps. They saluted smartly, each remembering a young man whom they had bounced on their knees, who had ridden his bike with Kaz's son and Dutch's, who had grown strong and proud, and whose luck had proven insufficient to the moment, 50 miles southwest of Da Nang. It was the curse of their professions, they knew, that their sons were drawn to it also. As each of the men standing there had taken their chances, so had Bobby Greer, Sonny Maxwell, and Stas Podolsky taken theirs. It was just that luck had not smiled on two of the three sons. Greer and Podolsky told themselves at this moment that it had mattered, that freedom had a price, that some men must pay that price. But those unspoken words rang hollow. The three men turned and left the grave without a word, heading slowly back to the driveway. Maxwell pulled himself up straight.
How did things look up the river, James? Have you been briefed on Boxwood Green?
No, Greer turned and cracked a smile. Do I want to be?
We'll probably need your help.
Under the table. You know what happened with the Kingpin mission, Podolsky noted.
They were damn lucky to get out, Greer agreed.
Keeping this one tight, eh?
You bet we are.
Let me know what you need. You'll get everything I can find.
How's Sonny doing? Greer asked. Flying for Delta now. Co-pilot. He'll make captain soon. And I'll be a grandfather in another month or so.
Really? Congratulations, my friend.
I don't blame him for getting out, Maxwell admitted. I used to. But not now.
What's the name of the SEAL who went in to get him?
Kelly. He's out, too, Maxwell said.
You should have gotten the medal for him, Dutch, Podolsky said. That was as hairy as they come.
I made him a chief. I couldn't get the medal for him, Maxwell shook his head. Not for rescuing the son of an admiral, Kaz. You know the politics.
Yeah, Podolsky stared at the endless lines of white headstones.
Yeah, I know about politics.
The package arrived with the very jet-lagged captain at the Navy's intelligence headquarters.
What do you think?
The master sergeant slid an ID photo over, comparing it to the photos from the drone. Close enough, I'd bet money on it. They had a match. Colonel Robin Zacharias, United States Air Force. They didn't know that what they had were photographs of a dead man.